Hi, I'm Denny Sorokin from Every Mother's Son and Rick Nelson of the Stone Canyon Band, and you're listening to Follow Your Dream with Robert Miller.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream, and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners worldwide in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. My guest today is John Jorgensen, Grammy Award-winning guitarist and multi-instrumentalist. His work spans country rock with the Desert Rose Band, guitar rock with the Hellcasters, and classical. He was a member of Elton John's band for 6 years. He won the Academy of Country Music Guitarist of the Year Award for 3 consecutive years. He's also toured or recorded with a who's who, including the Byrds, Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash, Barbara Streisand, Luciano Pavarotti, and Bonnie Raitt, among others. And in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musician guests, John and I are going to do a song fest. We're going to play a little bit of a handful of his best works, and we're going to talk about them. You'll get the backstories, and nobody else does this in podcasts. And you know that I feature a song of mine in every episode, underneath the introduction and at the end, and I always try to make it relevant somehow. And in this instance, I've chosen my song called Country Drive from the album Trippin' that I recorded with my band Project Grand Slam. That's the album that went to number one on Billboard. Why did I choose this song? Well, one of the many genres that's covered by John is country rock. And my tune that I wrote while driving down a country road has got that country rock kind of feel, I think. So I thought that it worked. So John Jorgensen, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast, baby.
Thank you, Robert. Glad to be here.
I'll tell you, you know, I want to start off with a compliment to you. You are one of the few guys that I know of that can toggle between classical music and I'll call it improvisational music. There are very few artists that can do that. In my opinion, it's because one is left brain and the other is right brain. And I was trying to make a little list of who I knew that could do that. And I came up with 3 names. And I want to see if you recognize these people. I'm sure you will. But if there's anybody else that I've left out. The first one, and this came up in another podcast, Andre Previn.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that surprises me, but only because I hadn't thought of it.
Well, I hadn't thought of it at the time either, but one of my guests said, well, you left out Andre Previn. And I said, yeah, you're right about that. Okay, number 2, I just interviewed a guy named John Cowan, who plays with the Doobie Brothers and Newgrass Revival. Newgrass Revival had a guy named Bela Fleck in the band for like 9 years.
Sure.
And he's one of my favorites.
Yeah. I know John very well and have known the Newgrass Revival since the 80s, you know. In fact, they were backing up Leon Russell the first time I saw him.
That's exactly right. He told the story.
And then that was actually pre-Bela, their original lineup. And then, since the 80s, was on festivals with them. John Cowan is just a great guy and a great talent. I played on his last album. I believe it was produced by John McPhee. Another buddy of ours.
All right, so he falls in that category.
Yeah. See, I thought you were going to say Wynton Marsalis.
Well, that was going to be number 3. You took that from me.
Okay, all right. All right, very good.
I was building up to Wynton.
Sorry.
Not a problem. Have I missed anybody?
Oh, God, I'm sure there's quite a number more. What about Brad Meldow?
Yeah.
But for me, it's just because I grew up playing both classical music and at first rock music. And my parents were both music educators. So I started studying really early when I was 4 years old. I would listen to my sister practice the piano. And I was the, you know, kid brother that, well, if she can do it, I can do it kind of thing. So when she was done practicing, I would go figure out what she played by ear. So my mom realized, okay, he can already play by ear, but I wanted to learn to read music too. So she started me in a different book so that I would have to learn how to read. So there was no kind of stigma about either one for me. And I know a lot of musicians have some sort of stigma about, if they're classical musicians, often it's about playing by ear and improvising. You know, if they're non-classical, not readers, then they have a thing about, oh, reading music is so whatever. So, but I feel very lucky that I didn't get any of that baggage. You know, it's just reading music is like reading words. You know, it's just something that you can do.
But it's more than just reading music, okay? You're interpreting somebody else's music, and you're talking about rather long pieces most of the time. It's an art form that's completely different, in my opinion, from the kind of improvisational music that you do in rock or that we do in jazz. And I think it's a remarkable talent. It's a remarkable talent.
Well, that's true.
Okay,
yeah.
It shows you're schizophrenic. That's what it says to me.
For me, yeah, for me, you know, music is just music. I mean, you're right that more often pop songs and jazz, they're shorter pieces of music. But every once in a while, you'll get, you know, In Memory of Elizabeth Reed or, you know, Tales of Topographic Oceans or something that's... So when I first discovered Yes as a teenager, I really resonated to them because they were kind of classical in a way, in their form and their approach to things, but still rock. So I like that. You know, it sort of validated that you could be sort of a classical musician geek and a rocker at the same time.
You know, you're right. Those prog groups that you're talking about, like in the Yes mold, yeah, they had very orchestrated numbers, but they also included a lot of improvisation. They were terrific. I remember that the first Yes album that I ever listened to, I guess it was Fragile. Was that the first one?
Well, that wasn't their first, but it was probably the first popular one in America, or maybe the Yes album.
Yeah.
Both of those. Yeah, good stuff.
All right. So I got to ask you about Elton John. Okay. You're with the guy for 6 years on the road. And I have to tell this little story. Elton John came to the United States in 1970. And I grew up in New York City. And there was a radio station at that time on the FM dial. And I remember it was WNEW, and they talked about a free concert that they were going to be doing with this new artist named Elton John. Nobody knew who he was. And sure enough, he played live on the radio, and that became the album 11-17-70, which was a magnificent album.
Incredible.
And that group that he had at the time with Dee Murray and Nigel Olsen, what a fantastic band.
Oh, an amazing trio. I think their goal, sort of, was to have as much power and dynamics as Jimi Hendrix, you know, or The Who, you know, other that were like a power trio, but it was about the piano instead of a guitar. And so, yeah, you're right. That's a document of an incredibly well-oiled trio. And they sang well, they played well. Yeah, amazing.
And I believe that they went out to the West Coast after they did that radio show in New York and they blew everybody down on the West Coast. And in fact, I'll tell you one other quick story. I went to see them right after that because I became a gigantic fan of Elton and the band. They played at the Fillmore East in New York City. They opened for Leon Russell.
Oh, okay.
People tell me I'm crazy, but I remember they went on and they blew the house away. So much so that Leon Russell refused to go on. Okay. That's how good they were.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
All right. So tell me about your time with Elton. Come on.
So I had a band called the Desert Rose Band. Chris Hillman was the lead singer of the band, and we were doing really well. We had our first album had four singles on it, two of them went number one. And so we were like a rising act at the time. And Chris Hillman's wife, Connie, worked for Elton John's management at that time. And so they managed Queen also. And so Elton, he's a sponge for all things musical. He knows everything about music. He really liked our first album a lot. He gave us quotes to use about it and helped us promote it. So when our second album was coming out, we had a concert at the Roxy Theater in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard. And Lyle Lovett was the opening act. In the audience was Bruce Hornsby, Rose Maddox, Dave Edmonds, Stephen Stills, Bernie Taupin, and Elton.
A bunch of nobodies.
And so we played our set, and we were really kind of at one of the peaks of, you know, at one of our peaks, I would say. And we finished the set, and Elton burst into the dressing room, grabbed my hand, said, "Brilliant guitar, brilliant." And I was like, "Wow, okay, you're Elton John, holy crap." So next time he was playing in the area, Connie Hillman said, "Do you want to go to Elton's concert?" I said, "Sure, yeah, I'd love to." She said, "Well, go early and go backstage. He wants to say hello to you." I'm like, okay. So I've made an impression somehow. And so I'm waiting backstage, sitting next to Sylvester Stallone and Bridget Nielsen and all these other celebrities. And Elton comes out and says, "How's it going? How's the band doing? It was a great concert. I really want you to meet my guitarist, Davey Johnston. I think you guys would get along great." And I said, "Yes, please. I'm a fan." So he introduced me to Davey. We became friends. And then at that time, I'd just done some recording with Bonnie Raitt. And Don was the producer of the album Nick of Time. So I played on that album.
By the way, that's a magnificent album.
Oh, I'm so proud to be part of it. And she's one of my favorite artists. But at that time, Don was scheduled to produce some cuts for a Elton John box set, like two or three new tracks for a box set. So I thought, okay, here's how it's going to come around. He'll call me for the sessions, and this will all come together like that. Well, I did get called, and then for whatever reason, it just never happened. So years went by. This was before cell phones or email or anything. Davey and I kind of lost contact with each other, and I just forgot about it. It was like, okay, whatever. And then 6 years later, I got a phone call from Elton. Said, "Hello, darling. It's Elton."
6 years later.
Yeah, 6 years later, out of the blue. And this, "Davey and I have been talking, and we'd like to add a guitarist to the band that could do a lot of harmony vocals. And you are the first person we thought of." I went, "Wow, okay, well, what are you asking me to do?" 18-month world tour. I said, 18 months? Wow. And at that time, I had left the Desert Rose Band. The Helicasters' first album had already come out and won a lot of awards. I was working back and forth in Nashville and Los Angeles in sessions, movie things, television things, all different kind. Like, my life was very, very interesting. And every day, something different. So the idea of dropping everything and doing one thing, even if it was a massive thing, it didn't sound like such a great idea to me at the time. And I said, "Well, 18 months, that's a long time." I said, "Could we have a meeting about it or something?" He says, "Yes, dear. Come to the Four Seasons Hotel, Sunday lunch at 1 o'clock, and we'll talk about it." So I did. And at the meeting, I said to his business manager, I said, "Well, I've got this band and I'm doing this and the blah, blah, blah. Will I be able to do any of those things?" And he said, "No, you'd be much too busy for that." And I was like, "Well, I don't know, you know?" And so Elton says, "Well, it sounds like you're too busy, but let me play you my new album." So he puts on his new album, which is called Made in England. And the first song in the album is Believe.
Believe in love.
And I went, oh, I like this. This sounds really good. This is like that classic British pop kind of Beatles sounding with strings. And I said, but it's probably the only good song on the album. Well, the next song comes on. The song is Made in England. It's a killer kick-ass song with lots of guitar. I mean, so literally every song, I liked the whole album.
He won you over, huh?
Well, musically he did, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one to say there's some period of years where his albums were not, you know, as good as other periods. But this was, to me, a return to form, this album. And then when I left the meeting, and I said, okay, well, Davey was with me. And I said, I have to think about it, you know. So a couple of days later, they called. They said, Elton wants to know why you don't want to play with him. I said, well, it's not that I don't. I'm thrilled, but I don't know that I'm ready to give up all the rest of my musical life just to do that. And then another couple of days went by. And finally, Davey said, look, if you don't want the gig, I'm going to have to find someone else. And that's when I went, uh-oh, no, nobody else is getting this.
Decision time.
So, yep. So I chose to go. And of course, I'm glad that I did because I made a lot of friends for life and got to do all kind of different things.
All right, hold on a second. You were reticent to do 18 months. How did it stretch to 6 years? I thought you were looking for time off for good behavior, huh?
At the end of the first touring season, I went to Elton's dressing room and I said, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I've had a great time. And he says, well, I think you're a great addition to the band and I'd like you to stay as long as you want. So he says, we're recording in London next month. And I'm like, okay, that sounds kind of good. You know. So it ended up stretching into 6 years. And then at the end of that time, he was doing a little bit more solo things, and there wasn't really so much work for the band. And I was kind of getting itchy to do some of my other music by that time. But the good thing is, that was 2000, I think, 2001, when I stopped playing with them the first time. But I've been back a number of times whenever they needed me for something, as recently as a few years ago for the farewell tour as well.
You mean the first farewell tour?
Well, this 5-year farewell tour, Farewell Yellow Brick Road. So I liken it a little bit to the mafia, where if you don't do anything wrong, you're always in the family. So I have a great relationship with him and with the rest of the band members. And yeah, it was a great experience. Some of the very best crew and sound people and lighting people and, you know, amazing, really, really great.
I'm just curious, at a tour at that level, I mean, this is the highest level that you can possibly get to, you know, McCartney and Elton and people like that.
Yeah.
Much does a tour cost to organize?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea about that.
It's got to be multiple millions of dollars, right?
Well, I mean, imagine just for insurance. You know, they're liable for all these truck drivers and spot operators and riggers and all that. You know, like that whole giant staging has to be moved from place to place. And yeah, I have no idea what the tour budget is, but a lot.
One of my grandkids was watching that new Taylor Swift movie about her current tour.
Right.
Which boggles the mind in terms of the amount of people and the mechanics and the lighting and this, that, and I'm saying, we've come a long way from four guys standing on a stage playing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's, yeah. I mean, the production values. Well, one of my friend's son is the head of the video component for that tour.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a whole staff of people underneath him. That's just the video, you know? So Yeah, I think everybody has kind of, they keep raising the stakes, you know, on those kind of things. I remember, actually, the lighting guy when I started with Elton was a guy named Steve Cohen. And toward the end of that time, he said, I've got another job and I want you to come and see the show. And it's probably not music that you're going to like, but I think you should come and see the show. I said, okay. Well, it was NSYNC and it was on their No Strings Attached tour. And they had conveyor belts, they had hydraulics, they had a piece of the stage that moved out over the audience. I mean, the production was crazy, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, 24 years ago. So it's just gotten more since then.
It's absolutely amazing. I agree with you.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. As a musician and composer, I've crossed multiple genres. My early work includes jazz rock instrumentals like Spring Dance. And ballads like Ma Petite Fleur. Later on, I segued into vocal songs like Redemption Road.
But I'll come back strong, trying to stay on Redemption Road. I try to rise, make you surprise, Redemption Road.
And along the way, I added collaborations with world-class musicians like Jim Peterik, Elliot Randall, and Tony Carey on The Fall of Winter.
He said, stand tall to yourself, be true. Don't let the fall of winter get the best of you. Had a voice like a boat from the blue. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you.
I also pride myself on the reimagined covers I've done, including The In Crowd.
I'm in with The In Crowd. I go where The In Crowd goes. I'm in with The In Crowd. And I know what The In Crowd knows. Yeah, yeah.
And then recently, I've come full circle with The Rich Ones, a jazz instrumental with guest artist Randy Brecker. For me, crossing genres helps keep the music fresh. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast and keep on rocking. All right, listen, I want to get to the Songfest portion because I want people to hear some of the stuff that you've done. And right now, I'm starting with that classical piece that you gave me, Concerto Grosso, which is a tarantella. You don't hear too many tarantellas anymore. Tell me about that, because I love that piece.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, it's I'm playing a gypsy jazz guitar, which is the style of guitar that Django Reinhardt played. When I first discovered Django, I just fell in love with how he played, the note choices, the techniques, the sound of his guitar. And so I learned how to play like that and started collaborating with an orchestra in Nashville And they commissioned me to write this piece. So I filled it full of all my classical knowledge and all of my gypsy jazz guitar knowledge. And I collaborated with a guy named Don Hart on the orchestration, who's done a lot of stuff with Trey Anastasio and many other artists. And we recorded it at a beautiful hall in Nashville called the Skirmerhorn Center, which is where the Nashville Symphony plays. And I think it's the only concerto that I know of for gypsy jazz guitar and orchestra.
All right, tell me this. Is this the kind of guitar that Django Reinhardt played?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And tell everybody this. There's a thing about Django Reinhardt that was completely unique, and I'm talking about his hands. Tell everybody what I'm talking about.
Well, Django, when he was a teenager, he was already a virtuosic musician, and he earned the money for his family at that time, playing with the biggest accordion players around Paris in the dance halls. And then when he was 18, his caravan that he lived in caught on fire, and he burned his hand really badly, especially the back part right here. So these two fingers were stuck in this position. He couldn't straighten them out.
The pinky and
the ring in your little finger.
Yeah, okay.
So while he was convalescing, someone brought a guitar, and he relearned how to play just basically using his index middle fingers. He could put these other on for chords, but he couldn't straighten them out. So most of his single note playing is just done with two fingers at a lightning speed all over the fingerboard. It's, if you haven't heard him, any listeners out there, D-J-A-N-G-O.
Right.
Guitar playing as we know it today would not be the same without him. He raised the bar for all the rest of us.
I couldn't agree more with you. And the fact that he played with the two fingers like that, quite remarkable. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is the Hellcasters. Completely different kind of guitar playing. I'm saying, who's playing guitar in this? Oh, it's John Jorgensen. Well, this is back on Terra Firma. This is rock guitar, baby.
Well, when the Hellcasters started, we were three telly players that were friends around LA. And we wanted to do a gig together where we were so often backing up singers, and we were kind of tired of that. So we said, let's us be the singers, let the guitars be the singers. So it'd be like the three tenors, the three Telecasters. And so we did a show just for fun. And I knew that people would expect a lot of blues jamming and a lot of chicken picking and a lot of that kind of stuff. But I didn't want to do that. We wanted to do pieces of music, melodies, more in the tradition of the Shadows, you know, and somewhat the Ventures, but more of the Shadows. More instrumental music, you know, with melodies, but song structures. So we had a few things, but we needed to fill out the set. So I wrote this song called Back on Terra Firma for our first gig. And it has become kind of a trademark. Actually, Tommy Emmanuel and his brother Phil took this song and recorded it and titled their album after it and ended up playing it at the Olympics in Sydney, Australia in 2000. So that made me really proud. So the version that you'll be hearing is the original recording of the Hellcasters, Back on Terra Firma.
very, very cool and very different from your gypsy jazz guitar in the first number. Okay, we're going to get to another one that's different. This is Come a Little Closer, the Desert Rose Band.
Oh, won't you come a little closer? We can make it all work out tonight. Come a little closer. Help me see it'll be all right. Come a little closer. We can have it all tonight.
And that's Chris Hillman doing the singing, isn't it?
Yeah, Chris Hillman on the lead vocal, and then Herb Peterson and myself are on the harmony vocals. And we were quite proud of our blend. This is a later song. It was a cut that we put on a greatest hits album with like two or three new tracks. And you'll hear a little bit of reggae influence in there. You'll hear a little more rock in my guitar playing. But this is probably one of the solos that I did with the Desert Rose Band that I'm most proud of. And I love the tone. It's got a little tapping in it. It's not a typical country guitar solo at all. But again, it's melodic and a little bit dramatic. So that's Come a Little Closer.
Well, it's a lovely song. And, you know, I've had Chris's partner, Richie Fiore, on the podcast a couple of times.
Oh, fantastic. Richie's a sweetheart.
He is a sweetheart. In fact, he did a concert for me, a live concert on the podcast, which was a lot of fun as well. That whole group of country rock artists, and you've played with some others. I mentioned the Byrds early on. That was kind of a West Coast thing, and it got started in the 60s. Tell me a little bit about your experience with all of those guys.
Well, Chris Hillman really was probably the door into it. But like I said, I'd already seen Rick Nelson and met Tom Brumley and Steve Duncan and Denny from Rick's band. And as you know, Randy Meisner from the Eagles was in Rick Nelson's band before. So the whole scene is very, very much intertwined. I was a huge fan of Linda Ronstadt and Andrew Gold and all of her band, Kenny Edwards. But through Chris, I ended up becoming friends with Roger McGuinn and played on Roger's album, Back from Rio, which was really a treat. And through that, met Tom Petty, because I was playing with Roger, and Stan Lynch was the drummer from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And through him, got to be friends with Howie Epstein, who was Tom's bass player at the time. And Tom was producing Carlene Carter and John Prine and asked me to come and play on those albums. And the John Prine album won a Grammy. And I'm still friends with Carlene to this day. Sadly, Howie has since passed away. But through that, I of course met David Crosby and got to record and play live with the Byrds, which is a thrill. Last year in Nashville, they open a new exhibit called Western Edge, and it's all the LA-centric bluegrass country and country rock from the early 60s to the early 90s. So starting off with the Dillards and the Byrds and Dillard and Clark Expedition and the Buffalo Springfield and the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris and all the way to the early 90s with Desert Rose Band and Dwight Yoakam. So we did a concert together with a lot of those artists, and the exhibit there is, I think it'll be there for another year and a half. And I'm proud to have one of my, a Rickenbacker 12 string and a matching turquoise box AC30 amp are there. I think it's probably the first AC30 and maybe the first Rickenbacker, certainly the first turquoise Rickenbacker to be in the Country Music Hall of Fame. So that's pretty cool.
Well, listen, what did Roger McGuinn play? Wasn't it a Rickenbacker? Wasn't
oh,
it
yeah,
a 12
sure.
string?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
That was the sound.
Oh, it was a beautiful sound. And I brought that sound into the Desert Rose Band kind of as an homage to Chris's earlier pass. And since then, I mean, at the time in the mid 80s, no one was doing that. It's become kind of part of the sound now of contemporary country music, along with the Dan Electra six-string bass, which I kind of pioneered as well. That was on our first two number one singles, featured the Dan Electra six-string bass. And so my whole kind of impetus was to bring some classic British guitar sounds into American roots country music.
Well, you've succeeded brilliantly at that. You've crossed so many genres and boundaries. We have been speaking here with John Jorgensen. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I love anybody that can play all the types of things that you have been playing. I've become a big fan of yours, I want you to know, and I want to thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome, Robert. Thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to listen now to that song that started off the episode. It's my song called Country Drive. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com.